This is Storycatcher with Patricia Glynn. Welcome to Inspirations, stories that go deeper with people who go further. We're stepping into the world of Southern Africans who are truly exceptional. And because they're living big and asking the big questions, our conversations here are longer than those on Potpourri. This month, stories from the Magaliesberg, these mountains and valleys that are ancient and rich. Rich in minerals, history, landscape, flora, fauna. In the valley next door to mine is a line of caves strung along the landscape like pearls. What they contain has caused the world to hold its breath at times, so extraordinary are their revelations. Vincent Carruthers has been studying and writing about the Magaliesberg for well on 50 years. He's also been teaching about it, and those thousands of talks have resulted in an extraordinary ability to make this story come alive and be accessible to those of us who don't know much about paleoanthropology. He's going to take us through the dramatic events that unfolded here, one by one, but he begins with an overview of why this place is such a wonderful repository of ancient material.
The extraordinary thing about the cradle of humankind is the enormous number of fossils that there are there, hominin fossils, probably ancestors of human beings. And they're not there because there were a lot of them living there. They're there because the geology of the caves is so exceptional in a number of ways. A lot of things come together. First of all, this whole episode took place in the comparatively short period of about 5 or 10 million years, where hominins were evolving from apes into humans. So the circumstances were there for this evolutionary process to take place. And secondly, the climate was moving gradually as the continent shifted, and the cradle of humankind and the Magaliesberg lies at the interface between bushveld, which was receding, and grassland, which was pushing the bushveld back. And so the apes were having to evolve from being arboreal animals that lived largely in the canopy of a forest to terrestrial animals that were bipedal and walked on their hind legs. So that transformation was taking place in and around the cradle area. Then the other thing was that the infrastructure on which they were walking was dolomitic caves, and the surface of the earth was eroding away, and gradually the caves underground were being exposed to the atmosphere. So little apertures opened in the ground through which things, bits and pieces, including the hominins, could occasionally fall. When they fell, the cave actually is a perfect laboratory for creating fossils, because the highly calcified water turns the bones of the animals as they rotted away into calcium fossils, which are preserved anyway. But then in addition, other stuff that was falling in, being sand and little bits of stones and rocks and so on, all accumulated in the on the base of the cave. And if you have stones and limey water and little bits of sand, that makes concrete. So the fossils were actually embedded in a concrete mix, which hardened, and they call it breccia, and that preserved the bones for eternity, virtually, until a paleontologist would come along and dig them out, excavate them.
The thing is, when these fossils are dug up, they are largely cleaned up, labelled, put into little plastic boxes, and housed at Wits University. There they lie for decades, waiting for someone to find a place for them in the story of our convoluted and mysterious evolution.
Now, one of the extraordinary things about this study of ancestry is the really minimal amount of information that we have. If you can imagine that the story of information is a jigsaw puzzle, and you've got a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle that you've just bought for yourself, and you've got a box that it came out of, and on the box lid there is a picture of the thing that you're trying to make up, and here you've got 1,000 little bits and pieces that you've got to put together on cold winter's nights, it's a lot of fun, some people think, to put it all together. But what we have in our human evolution, and let's assume that the story of humankind or Homo sapiens is the big picture that was on the box, but we've lost the box lid. We don't know where that is. We don't know what the picture is that we're trying to draw. And we've only got about half a dozen pieces. We've lost the rest, or we haven't found the rest yet. So we're stuck with a couple of pieces, and we're trying to tell the story that's on the top of the box. It really is an extraordinarily difficult thing to achieve. And that's why our theories of evolution, of human evolution, change so often, because we find, just suddenly, we'll find another piece. And we'll say, oh, hang, all the stuff that we thought was making the picture isn't actually making the picture, because here's another piece that we've got to fit into the puzzle. One of the things that is confusing it, and did confuse things in the original series of events, was that there were obviously more than one species of hominin, which were still keeping in the subfamily, which did not become Homo sapiens. They went extinct. And so the discovery that there were several possible ancestors, but we don't know which one it was. We don't have a nice line. We can't say this one was that one's parent and that one was that one's great parent. And we can't trace the line straight through to from ape to Homo sapiens. We've got a lot of confusing twigs on the branch. This family tree has got a whole lot of funny things on it, and we don't know exactly how they will work.
Nonetheless, from those twigs hang, like baubles on a Christmas tree, the riveting tales of men and fossils that have captured our imaginations for 100 years.
In zoology, the ending, the suffix ID, means a family. And hominids are the family of apes, which we used to call anthropoid apes. They're apes without tails, the gorillas, the chimpanzees, and the human beings. And some of these other ancestral things that are all apes. They belong to that particular family, the ape family, and so they are hominids. But only some of them appear to have been in this ancestry of human beings. They're a subfamily, which we call hominin. And if you end in an IN, that's a subfamily of hominid. And it's those particular anthropoid apes, which some of which turned into Homo sapiens.
We have the gold mines to thank indirectly for the discovery of our fossils, because in order to process the gold, which was fast becoming South Africa's most lucrative product, they needed lime. So miners came to this precious cradle of ours, realized there was limestone to be had, and blasted the caves to smithereens to get it. Who knows how many invaluable fossils they destroyed, but the exposed jagged walls and chunks of rocks they left behind had pieces of what looked like bone sticking out of them. And that ignited the interest of fossil hunters.
The story really begins almost exactly 100 years ago, 1924, when a lime miner in Taung, now Taung has got a lot of lime fossils. The same story as happens in the Cradle of Humankind. Now, that was being mined for lime in the 1920s. And a lime miner found fossils in it. And he knew that Raymond Dart, who was a newly appointed professor of anatomy at Wits University, was interested in this kind of thing. And so he sent him a box of fossilized skulls, most of which were monkeys and apes of various sorts, but one of which puzzled Raymond Dart a great deal. And he picked it apart, he exposed it from the breccia in which it was buried, and he realized that this was probably an ancestor of human beings. This was what he called the missing link, and that phrase, the missing link, came into popular use. And he published within quite a short time, within a year, and in paleontological work, that is a short time, to put out a paper and say, I have found the missing link. Well, he got a deluge of opposition from all the guys who knew much better than he did. Remember, this is a young professor just appointed to a brand new university. The Wits University was only 2 years old. He was the first professor of anatomy. Worse still, he was an Australian, so he really must be wrong. And here he was saying that he had discovered the missing link between apes and humans, and he's basing it on a juvenile skull. The skull that was found was actually a baby. It was a child of two or three. So he just got huge opposition.
And the biggest opposition he got was from scientists in England, who were very largely taken in by a local piece of masterful skullduggery, if you'll excuse the pun. For them, there was no debate. They had found that mysterious thing called the missing link, the intermediate species between man and ape. And they were proudly presenting a skull to the world to prove it.
We have found a skull in a quarry in Surrey, in Piltdown, in Surrey in England, that has a large brain as big as a human being's, but it has an ape's jaw. And this must obviously be the missing link, because we would have needed that big brain to be humans, and we would, but we haven't developed the lower jaw. Dart said, no, it was the other way around. We actually had a small brain, but we gradually grew it bigger and bigger as we developed things like hands and bipedal walking, and we became bodily a human being before we became mentally a human being. So the controversy ranged, but there was this Piltdown fossil that was, it was beyond argument. Well, it was beyond argument for the very best people in the world to argue for it for 40 years. Until 1953, and it was shown to be a fraud. And these guys, there was a bloke called Dawson who had discovered it, he said. He had died by 1950, so if he had created it as a malicious fraud, we don't know. But he probably did. He probably thought this was a joke. But he died with that joke, and nobody discovered it. Until a guy who was actually born a South African, but wasn't a paleontologist, he was an anatomist in London called Wiener, who'd been born in South Africa. He looked at this thing in the 1950s and he said, this is a fraud. This is a human skull, quite modern, probably 100 years or so old. It's got an orangutan's jaw glued onto the bottom of it. The whole thing has been quite purposefully stained and stressed so it looked like it was millions of years old, but it's rubbish. It's an absolute fraud. And the biggest name of the whole lot in this whole Piltdown thing was Sir Arthur Keith, who was the doyen of paleontology and had defended the Piltdown man for 40 years, had to apologize and say, I'm sorry, even though I'm an extremely eminent scientist, probably the best in the world, young Professor Dart, the Australian in South Africa, is actually right. And so the whole pattern changed. But that was the first skull to be found. But the other person in the story was Robert Broom. Now, Robert Broom was actually a doctor, a medical doctor, didn't like being a doctor. He'd practiced in the Karoo for a while, was a small town doctor. He was a Scotsman, but he had a practice there which he didn't really enjoy. He was into paleontology. And he was actually looking at some of the Karoo fossils of therespids, which are the intermediate fossils between mammals and reptiles, and they are abundant in the Karoo. That's what interested him. But when he heard about this skull, which was intermediate between apes and humans, that got him going. He went to see Raymond Dart and he said, hey, I'm your disciple. I think you're right here. But one of the other arguments besides the Piltdown man against the Raymond Dart skull was that it was a juvenile. It was, and they said, well, this could have actually matured into anything. We're not sure that it's what you're claiming that it is. Dart was convinced, but Broom said, okay, I'm going to go and find an adult for you. Anyway, Robert Broom had this incredible ability to find fossils, and in Sterkfontein Cave, he found the adult version of what Raymond Dart had described from Tarong. And now the whole focus of paleoanthropology shifted to Sterkfontein, to what is now the cradle of humankind. What he found, he thought was a different species, so he didn't call it Australopithecus africanus, which is what was the name that Raymond Dart had given. He called it Plesianthropus transvaalensis. Now that, as you can imagine, although the press and the media was very excited about it, it was way beyond them to put that name down in the popular press, so they nicknamed it Mrs. Pless. It was another decade of mostly war years before Robert Broome found a much better looking specimen of the same thing. And that was the next very important skull to be found, because that put Dart's Australopithecus, or the Taung child, into a lineage which they thought at the time was the line of ancestry of human beings. But then Broome found another thing, which he called Paranthropus, got the nickname Robust Man or Robust Ape. It was very similar, but as the name implies, it was much more robust. And
bigger head, bigger jaw.
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind
and
of
it, thing. And it had a great big cranial crest on the skull to which a huge muscle would have been fastened. So this thing could bite through anything. It meant that it was living on things like nuts and hard roots and so on, whereas the little Taung skull person, the Australopithecus, was having to find softer foods and probably more omnivorous, living on meat as well. But Robustus was certainly vegetarian. But it showed for the first time that actually our ancestry was a bit more complicated. This was not a line of mother to daughter, daughter to mother, mother to daughter. It was a complex of different things that were evolving in this great change from savanna to grassland, or from forest to savanna. So there was another thing out there called the Robustus that showed that there was a complexity. Since then, incidentally, we found other skulls and other fossils that show that there were actually several different things coexisting at about the same time in the same paleoanthropological time. They were all coexisting together. And the other thing that happened in the early 1950s, that South Africa became an apartheid country, and there was an academic boycott. South African paleoanthropology went onto the back burner, as it were.
And it was on that back burner for many years, roughly 40, in fact. The world turned its attention to the finds in East Africa. Those who made them, the Leakeys, Mary and Louis, and later Richard and Meave, became household names, with movie star auras as they chipped away in the desert. But our cradle had not by any means finished yielding its secrets, and in 1994 it gave up quite possibly the most famous of all. How appropriate that it revealed itself in the year of our liberation, as if to celebrate the end of the long years of paleoanthropological exclusion from the world. The fossil became known as Littlefoot, and it was discovered by Ron Clark.
He was quite a junior person at the time. And he was fossicking around, that's probably the wrong word, because he was looking at boxes of old fossils. And incidentally, he found a small foot bone. And he realized that it had been snapped in recent times. This was not a break in the foot from paleontological times. This had happened somewhere recently, which meant that somewhere down in the dark depths of the Sterkfontein Caves was the other bit of this foot. And he asked his two assistants to go and help him, and they found, buried in the Silverberg Grotto, which is a rather isolated little piece of the caves, the bit that this foot fitted onto. It was the leg bone to which this foot fitted. Then he realized that actually the rest beyond this foot was buried in Brescia. Therefore, probably the whole skeleton was there. Now, never in the whole history of paleontology had they discovered a whole, complete skeleton. It's always the head and a bit and a piece. And I mentioned bits of puzzle. They're not even the whole bit of the puzzle. They're bits of bits. But here he thought he might have the whole darn thing. What's more, the Silverberg Grotto is a very, very old part of the cave. It is dated way earlier than all these Australopithecans and Mrs. Plessers and so on, at least by 500,000 years, maybe more. So he got very excited about this and worked on it, but it took him 20 years of excavation of this fossil.
In secret?
Yes, and he worked, initially he worked in secret, because Paleontology, sadly, is a discipline that is hugely competitive, probably because it gets a lot of press attention when they do make a discovery, which is only once in a while, in a very long while, and the bloke who finds the thing becomes famous overnight. So there's a lot of ego drive in this discipline. And his big competitor was Professor Lee Berger, and they didn't like one another, and they were competitive in their field. Berger had not found anything of great significance, and here Ron Clark, who was his junior, actually, in the hierarchy of the department, had found something very special. So he kept it secret, and Lee Berger was sidelined, actually, because of that.
Lee Berger went on to make some historic discoveries, and we'll get to those in due course. But Ron Clark's find was just incredible.
Now, this whole being, which was incidentally a female, and because they've got the whole skeleton, they know that for sure from the hip size and things like that. But she had suffered that dreadful fate of falling into a cave. And there's very little else in that cave. So it must have been a very small aperture. She fell in and it would appear that she was alive for a while at the bottom of the cave, where she would have starved to death or bled to death or something. She fell with her head on her arm on a slope on the cave, and that's where she was fossilized for the next 3.7 million years. That is not only the only complete fossil, but it is also the oldest of all the hominin fossils that have been found in the cradle of humankind. It is a very, very old and complete fossil, and it tells us a good deal, and it will continue to tell us because it's being studied even now. They're looking at new things in the Littlefoot skeleton that tells us, and because it's a complete skeleton, we can tell a lot. I mean, the first obvious thing is that it was a female, but there's much more that we can tell: how they lived, what kind of diet they had, all sorts of stuff can come out of the study.
How they moved, I would think.
Yes, the locomotion, all of those things.
Littlefoot set the world alight, and not just the paleoanthropological world. She was pictured and described in the media as if she was a walking, breathing celebrity. South Africa was back in the paleo game, and we had many other discoveries to come that would keep us at the top of that game. The next made a very different contribution to our understanding of our slow amble towards being human. It was a fossil that was much, much younger than Littlefoot, and its abilities completely changed our trajectory in our long walk to becoming human.
The most recent hominin fossil that is not Homo sapiens from Sterkfontein is a thing called Homo ergaster, or working man. That looked pretty much like a human being. It had a smaller brain, but it unquestionably could make tools. And what's really exciting about it, it could also use fire. It could control fire. This was a discovery that was made by Bob Brain in the Swartkrans cave, which is just opposite Sterkfontein, just about half a kilometer away. There's another cave similar to that. And there he found an extraordinary thing, that there were lots of bones there, not only hominin bones, but other animals and things, and they were burnt. And that's not unusual because things get caught in felt fires, but there were a lot of bones that were burned all in one place. And then he made a study of bones. He took bones. He's a very thorough man, Bob Brain. And he and Liz Verber, his assistant, who also became very famous at Yale University, took a bone, a chicken bone, for example, from the kitchen, and they burnt them and saw what happened. If they burned them over a long period, as one might if you cooked the meat, the burn effect on the bone is very different from if it's caught in a fire and the animal is killed and just burns to death. And from that, looking at a lot of bones, a huge sample of them, he worked out that these people were cooking. Therefore, they knew how to control fire. It's not... So in fact, it's almost certain that they didn't know how to ignite a fire. They couldn't make a fire. But what they would have done is collected burning coals after a felt fire, which they're often in grassland, particularly. Felt fires go through after lightning storms. They would have gone and collected a burning log or a smouldering log and kept it alive in the camp permanently. And I'm sure, given what we know about these early people, or early hominins, they probably associated that a lot with spiritual things. Keeping the fire alight was clearly very important because it not only cooked meat, which meant you could digest it better. Raw meat is very indigestible. Cooked meat isn't. You could, the hours of the day could be prolonged by the light of a fire. It kept wild animals away, and it warmed you in winter. So the ability to have fire was a massive leap in our evolution. And that was the discovery that Bob Brain made. A million years ago, at least, maybe more, hominins were able to keep and use fire on a useful basis. And that really accelerated our change. And Homo ergaster, the working man, a working hominin, is probably the species that first migrated out of sub-Saharan Africa. Remember that all of this evolution of Homo, the genus Homo, took place south of the Sahara. There were no other humans or anything looked like a human anywhere else in the world. Even the big apes in North America or Asia could not or did not turn into human beings. Only those south of the Sahara did. But eventually, and again because of climate change, some of them escaped, if you like, or migrated away and got into Europe. Homo ergaster probably did, and it became a fossil which is discovered in Asia called Homo erectus, which means an upright standing man. And we think that that was a direct descendant of the African ergaster. And they're recent enough and datable enough to be fairly confident of that. Our bits of the jigsaw puzzle are beginning to make a bit more sense with the picture of human beings.
Can I just ask if this Bob Brain's actual fire hearth,
yes,
is that identifiable as one place, a site?
It wasn't a hearth that he found. He thinks that the hearth was outside of the cave, Swartkrans cave. But Swartkrans is where he found these bones. Mm-hmm. What he suspects, because a lot of other stuff was washed into the cave, was that these bones got washed in and they accumulated inside the cave. But they would have started from a point outside of the cave and just were washed in. But he actually found them undercover, as it were. And he could date them and he could equate them to the period that Homo ergaster was occupying that cave. And that is another thing that he discovered. And that is that the hominins, these Homo ergasters, working men, were using the cave as a shelter. And that was another new innovation because...
How on earth did he discover that?
Because they had a fire there, so they would have been inside the cave.
It was something that they returned to of an evening.
Another answer to your question, how did he discover that? Because he made another extraordinary discovery. Raymond Dart came to the conclusion, because he found a lot of bones too, and in caves you do find bones, and they are the work of Homo ergaster, but he found bones that were broken open and broken into shapes, which he decided were weapons. And he came up with this wonderful word called the osteodontocratic culture.
Oh, I'm so glad you taught us that.
Osteo being bone, donto being dent or teeth, and keratic being nails or claws. These prehumans belonged to a culture that killed each other. They were homicidal. And they broke bones to make weapons, and they hunted with them, obviously, but they also killed each other because there were broken hominin bones there as well.
When he published his findings about the Taung child in 1953, Dart wrote them up in rather vivid prose for a scientist. He said, "Man's predecessors differed from living apes in being confirmed killers, carnivorous creatures that seized living quarries by violence, battered them to death, tore apart their broken bodies, dismembered them limb from limb, slaking their ravenous thirst with the hot blood of victims and greedily devouring livid, writhing flesh." Look, it has to be said here that description could easily fit the behavior of some modern apes. We know this from the observations of Jane Goodall, among others. Forest chimps hunt their own kind and antelope, and adolescent female members of savannah chimps in Sudan have been known to fashion spears from branches and skewer bush babies for food.
However, Bob Brain was able to show, because of his study of bones and the burning of them, that also these bones were not broken by the hominins. They were broken by predators. And he did that by looking at live hyenas in particular, which have the jaw capacity to crack a bone, and all of these bones were broken by hyenas, including the hominins. So his famous book called The Hunters or the Hunted, he demonstrated that his tutor and the guy who'd actually given him all his training, Raymond Dart, was wrong. This was not a cultural thing. It is not inbred in humans to kill each other. We've certainly developed the habit quite well, but that was not an ancestral thing that goes back into our evolution. And he describes very nicely in this book of his how he approached Dart and said, "Professor Dart, this is my discovery." And he laid out his things, and Dart said, "Nice work. Well done." And accepted it straight away without even questioning the validity of it. It has now been accepted that human beings were actually the prey, for the most part, of things like saber-toothed tigers and leopards and stuff.
So we've left things that Ron Clark was getting all the glory with Littlefoot, and Lee Berger had to wait, as it happens, until Homer Naledi came along. In between then, we had what famous...
Well, actually, it was Lee Berger who did something else. He is the first of all of these paleoanthropologists to rely less on pure serendipity and just the good luck, of which he had had very little. And he started to use things like Google Earth to spot caves or places where he thought caves might be from aerial or satellite pictures. And he surveyed the whole of the cradle of humankind and a little bit beyond. And he could find places where there were caves, and he went to those places. And long before he found Homo Naledi, he found Sidiba at a cave that he knew that, or he was certainly strongly suspicious that there would be fossils in this particular spot, which he had done from a satellite picture. He went there with his son and was wandering around looking for stuff, and his son Matthew picked up a clavicle, which is the shoulder bone, and said, "Hey, Dad, isn't this a fossil?" And it was. Now, a clavicle, if you look at a skeleton, the shoulder bone is very thin, and actually it survives far less likely. It is far less likely to survive than the main leg bones and the skull. So this was a remarkable find in itself. And what Lee found was that this was probably a well, or the cave had filled with water, and it was probably these caves collapse every now and again. They become sinkholes. Very likely this was a sinkhole in the time of this fossil, and that people went down and gathered water from the area. But it, like all sinkholes, it was dangerous, and a number of them fed in. So where Ron Clark had found the complete skeleton, Lee discovered a whole family, or at least a number, a woman and at least two or three children, almost complete, and he put the bones together and actually could make children and a woman, I think two women, right. And he called the place Malapa, which is the Tswana for a well where there's water. And he built a wonderful structure, or not he, he got a structure built, which is an oval platform that surrounds the site where he found these fossils. And spectators can go, or visitors can go out there. They approach on a boardwalk, so you don't touch the landscape at all or damage it. Get onto this elevated platform and look down into where the paleontologists are working. And for a long time, this Australopithecus sediba was a very famous. It is another intermediate fossil, slightly more evolved than Australopithecus africanus, the old Taung skull, and the Mrs. Plessis. It was slightly different to that.
But its fame was to be superseded, and how. What Lee Berger was to discover next has put him in the unassailable position of being South Africa's most famous paleoanthropologist ever. It was the discovery of Homo Naledi, and its story is the most dramatic of them all, I think. That story is going to be told by someone who is intimately involved in it, Dr. Kinelwe Molopiane. So join us for part two of our Stories from the Cradle of Humankind. You'll find it also under Inspirations on the podcast page. My thanks to Vincent Carruthers, who has lived, walked, and breathed the Magaliesberg for 50 years and written at least two seminal books about the region. The one which I think you'll find most useful if you're interested in what we chatted about today is called Cradle of Life. It's illustrated with photographs, diagrams, maps, drawings, and makes complex material easy to understand, just as Vincent does. If you live in Gauteng, of course, you really should drive out here to the cradle, acquaint yourself with your ancestors in one of our museums or digs, and then enjoy a slap-up meal at one of the restaurants around here. My copy editor for Inspirations is David Lampkin, and the audio editor is Amy Moss. Keep your suggestions coming for people who are living big and asking the big questions. They are the people we feature here on Inspirations. Chat soon.